Rebonjour. Installez-vous et nous allons commencer ce deuxième panel. Alors, donc, rebonjour et bienvenue à ce deuxième panel de la journée, portant cette fois-ci sur l'organisation, le financement, la gestion et les structures rédactionnelles du journal indépendant du 21e siècle. Alors, vous avez sans doute remarqué qu'il nous manque un panéliste. Malheureusement, M. Bernard Poulet devait retourner en France en catastrophe parce qu'il a appris le décès de son père. Alors, il était déjà rendu à Montréal, il s'est reviré de bord pour retourner à Paris. Et donc, nous avons jugé compte tenu de son absence, je vais livrer moi-même, dans son nom, quelques éléments du texte qu'il nous avait fourni et qui d'ailleurs est inclus dans le cahier thématique du devoir que la plupart d'entre vous ont déjà pris, mais peut-être que vous n'avez pas eu la possibilité de le lire. Alors, je ferai ça brièvement en début du panel et ensuite nous passerons à tour de rôle au deuxième panéliste présent, Karen Dunlap et Robert Picard, que je présenterai en temps et lieu. Donc, comme vous savez, M. Bernard Poulet est rédacteur en chef au magazine économique français L'Expansion. Il a déjà été rédacteur en chef de Courrier international et de l'événement de jeudi. Il a rejoint le magazine L'Expansion en 2001 en qualité de rédacteur en chef en charge de la rubrique Idées fortes et des forums de l'Expansion. Il a publié en 2009 un livre intitulé « La fin des journaux », titre provocateur s'il y en a, et il avait également publié auparavant « Le pouvoir du monde quand un journal veut changer la France » en 2003. Alors, et là, c'est M. Poulet qui parle et je résume ou je fais la synthèse. C'est autour de l'an 2000 que dans les pays développés, les journaux d'information et plus largement les conditions de production de cette information ont encaissé des chocs violents qui remettent en cause leur survie. Et plusieurs phénomènes se sont conjugués à ce moment-là, l'érosion dans le lectorat des journaux, le départ des jeunes générations de ce lectorat, et ça s'inscrit dans un phénomène qu'il identifie comme faisant partie du développement de l'individualisme, la dépolitisation, l'effondrement des grandes organisations de masse, ainsi de suite, qui ont tous modifié les rapports des publics à l'information. Parallèlement à ça, il y a le développement du digital, du numérique, qui change radicalement l'économie des médias. Et avec cette, dans ce contexte convergé, si vous voulez, il y a d'une part la chute de la valeur de la plupart des journaux, et notamment aux États-Unis, on assiste à la disparition ou à la mise en faillite de nombreux titres devenus trop déficitaires ou trop endettés. Donc, le modèle qui a présidé à l'apparition de la grande presse d'information de qualité au 19e siècle ne peut plus fonctionner. Mais la baisse de la qualité de l'offre qui en résulte alimente encore la spirale, les nouvelles baisses du lectorat, les nouvelles baisses des revenus publicitaires, les nouvelles réductions de coûts, etc. Le modèle du grand quotidien de qualité, le New York Times, en est un qui fait figure de ce que M. Poulet appelle la figure de dinosaure dont on guette la disparition. Et plus largement, c'est la capacité même de financer une production d'information de qualité et de masse, quel que soit le support, qui est remise en cause. Personne ne sait, pas même ceux qui envisagent de faire payer leur contenu numérique, comment financer la production d'informations de qualité de masse. Et M. Poulet conclut, c'est irréversible et tout est à réinventer. La forme journal va sans doute disparaître, mais aucune société ne peut vivre sans information. Alors, le risque qu'il voit apparaître, c'est qu'on évolue vers un monde avec une information à deux vitesses, où les riches ou ceux qui peuvent payer pourront s'apprivoiser en information, tandis que les pauvres ou les autres qui n'ont pas le luxe de se payer l'information de qualité en seront dépourvus. Et il termine avec une question. N'est-ce pas un grand défi pour nos démocraties? Merci. Alors, notre prochaine conférencière est Karen Dunlap, présidente et directrice générale du Poynter Institute en Floride. Le Poynter Institute est à la fois une école réputée de journalisme et aussi propriétaire d'un journal quotidien indépendant d'une certaine importance, The St. Petersburg Times. Et je pense que Mme Dunlap va nous parler du Poynter Institute, bien sûr. Je suis certain qu'elle va nous parler aussi du St. Petersburg Times. Et il faut dire que quand on évoque l'hypothèse des journaux, de créer des sociétés à but non lucratif ou de restructurer les journaux dans une autre, selon un autre modèle, The St. Petersburg Times est un exemple vivant dont on peut tirer beaucoup de leçons. Alors, le Poynter Institute, c'est une école de journalisme, elle aussi à but non lucratif, et elle va nous parler un peu de ses origines et de son fonctionnement. Madame Dunlap elle-même a une vaste expérience en journalisme ainsi qu'à l'enseignement. Elle détient un doctorat. Elle a longtemps fait partie de l'Institut Poynter où elle a été la doyenne avant d'assumer la présidence. Alors, Karen Dunlap.
Thank you, Mark. Let me say first, I came here from Florida to talk a little bit in this session, but also to listen a lot. And I have listened, I've learned, I really commend the organizers of this event. I say thank you to the previous speakers, and I commend the audience. I'm not sure what has drawn each of you here, but there have been good questions, really good questions and good comments. As he indicated, I want to talk a little bit about not-for-profit newspapers, and I will use the term nonprofit interchangeably. I want to talk about it primarily through the lens of the St. Petersburg Times and the Poynter Institute. Then I'll mention some others and what are we learning from nonprofit ownership of news. The St. Petersburg Times on the west coast of Florida is considered one of the United States' best newspapers. Now, it makes that claim based on a ranking of newspapers by Time magazine. I don't think they've done that ranking in at least 30 years. If you were on that list the last time they ranked it, you can still claim to be one of the best. But in addition to that, last year, the St. Petersburg Times won two Pulitzer Prizes. I think the only news organization to have more was the New York Times. I'll come back to that and the type of prizes, but it is indeed a good newspaper. It is also the largest circulating newspaper in the state of Florida, although St. Petersburg, and in fact Tampa Bay, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, is not the most populous area, but it is the largest circulating paper. I'm on the board of the Times, and I'm president of the Institute. And what we have is an arrangement in which the school, the Poynter Institute, owns a newspaper. Some have called it a hybrid nonprofit ownership model because the newspaper is a for-profit organization owned by a nonprofit, not-for-profit school. And people tend to get that wrong, and it's funny how the publishers and the CEO of the St. Petersburg Times greet that. They are not a not-for-profit. They are indeed a for-profit organization, and the Poynter Institute is pleased because we were largely financed and continue to be from the dividends of the St. Petersburg Times. The newspaper is fairly easy to understand. The Poynter Institute is a little more difficult to imagine. So, Ben, if you help me, I wanted to show some a few slides. It is after lunch, and a few pictures might help. It's been there. He's got it. What is Poynter? Well, first of all, it's a nice place in St. Petersburg. It's a school, and it's important to us that we are a school. We are set up by tax structure, and you'll see why that's important as a school. So we're not a foundation. We are often called a think tank. We kind of hate that. We're a lot of things, but we are basically a school. We have programs that are usually week-long seminars populated usually by mid-career journalists. In the past, they have been sent by their news organizations. We also have some programs for younger people, but primarily we serve working journalists. We bring in professionals from around the nation throughout the year as teachers along with our existing faculty. It's not only a school, but it is also a site online. Poynter.org has been ranked the number one place that people turn to for news. That's Poynter.org. We also have a website, newsu.org. People also think of us as a place, and you see it's an architecturally award-winning building. So we are a school, we're a site, we're a place, we're online. We try to train journalists anywhere, as we put it. NewsU is, I hope you will look at either one of those. You can get self-directed courses there at newsu.org. The purpose here is that we are an idea. We're an idea of Nelson Poynter, and that's where I want to spend a little time. And as I tell a little bit about Nelson Poynter, I'm a journalist and I basically will tell stories. You'll hear similarities to something you've heard earlier today, as you heard of Joseph Atkinson. I was very interested in the parallels and the Toronto Star. Nelson Poynter grew up in Indiana, and his father bought several newspapers in Indiana before moving to the west coast of Florida and buying the St. Petersburg Times, which was a pretty much failing paper, nothing particularly to get excited about. At some point, Nelson Poynter started working for his father and eventually bought the newspaper. He was a creative thinker, and he converted it into a leading paper. He was one of the first to experiment with color. He had big ideas about what a newspaper ought to be, and one of his most important ideas was that it ought to serve its community. I think one of his quotes was something like, a newspaper ought to have one community that it loves best. And so he did not like the idea of chain ownership as it began to develop. Like Atkinson, as he grew older, he began to think about what would happen to his newspaper, how could he further his ideas long after his death. By this time, he had graduated from Indiana University, and then he'd earned a master's in economics from Yale. And he decided that he tried to think about how to pass it intact so that it could successively be led by what he thought of as a qualified individual. And he was a great believer that it ought to be one person in charge. So he wanted to pass it intact successively to one individual who would lead the organization. At first, he thought about a foundation as owner, and he created the Poynter Fund. Now, he had already dismissed the concept of family ownership. There was a quote that he said he didn't want to pass his paper to grandchildren he'd never met and wasn't sure he'd like. But he'd already experienced some family squabbles in dividing up the ownership between his sister. His mother kept saying, give her some. So he ruled out family. He thought about a foundation. He was moving down the track of willing his organization to a foundation when sort of the same thing happened around 1969. The laws in the U.S. changed. And one story says that there was an elected official who was not happy with the situation in Houston, Texas, where a foundation owned a newspaper, and that official had the law changed to say foundations could not own a newspaper. So about that time, Nelson Poynter asked for further clarification about what was open to him. And what he learned was that the changes in the law permitted, although a foundation could own a newspaper, charitable organizations that could include hospitals, churches, and schools. And he liked the idea of a school owning his news organization because he would not only preserve the organization as he wanted it, and that means it would be independent and locally owned, but he also had the opportunity to help educate the next generation of journalists, to improve journalism year by year. And so he created what he called the Modern Media Institute in 1975. And what that means is that this is our 35th year of the Poynter Institute, and his idea has stood up for 35 years. The structure is often confused. Indeed, the Institute owns the school, but the Institute does not operate the school. It did come forth that we still have one person in charge. And so according to his structure, what still exists is there is one person who is, in effect, CEO of the newspaper, editor slash publisher, depending on how he decides to, and it has been how he decides to use the title. And he's also chairman of the board of the Poynter Institute. So one person has an opportunity to oversee all of the operations, and the tradition has been to see about the good of each, and that has worked well. The entities include the Poynter Institute, Time Publishing, which owns some additional publications besides just the St. Petersburg Times, and the St. Petersburg Times. That's pretty much the structure there. And there's a lot of advantages in that, because basically what it means is that you can have a school encouraging excellence through the teaching of skills and values associated with a newspaper that is about the daily practice of excellence. Last year is a good example of how this worked well. The newspaper celebrated a major anniversary, I think it was 125 years. And during that year of celebration, it won those two Pulitzer Prizes. But those prizes are worth looking at. And as I heard some of the discussion here this morning, I thought about it's really important to think about those two Pulitzers. One was for feature writing. It was for long-form story, the kind of story that takes a skilled reporter, takes time to do. The story was called A Girl in the Window. And what it was about was nearby Tampa, within our service area, it turned out that there was a girl who had basically, a child, been raised without care until she was about 7 years old. That means her mother had given birth to her, and it basically had her in a room where she would feed her. She'd give her food, but nothing much else. And the mother lived in the community. She had older sons. She had adult sons, and there was this little girl in the room. What struck people was in a metropolitan area, you have a child who's not seen by anybody and whose existence is not pretty much known, except when she was finally, the police finally came. One neighbor said, at one point, I thought I saw a girl in the window. So you have this compelling feature story that was told over time, that was told online and in print, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. But the other Pulitzer Prize was for PolitiFact, the online news service designed to test the truth of what politicians are saying. So very different approaches to the news, both by an award-winning, winning awards. And people tended to say, to wonder, is that type of journalism possible in environments other than a non-profit ownership? That's the St. Petersburg Times and the Poynter Institute. You've probably heard of other schools, and I'll just mention some. You've heard of some in this country. In the U.S., the Nacky Loeb School followed the Poynter Institute. It's owned by the Manchester Union Leader, and that newspaper decided to create a school to take charge of it. I think it's a much smaller school. Nacky Loeb was the wife of the publisher. She was a granddaughter of the Scripps of Scripps Howard newspaper. And so there's a Nacky Loeb School of Journalism owning that school. More recently, the Anderson Star in Alabama has created an arrangement with the University of Alabama School of Journalism. The owner of the Anderson Star, Brandy Ayers, is a well-known, popular senior figure in journalism. He inherited the paper from his father. He has the same community interest in maintaining the paper that looks after its community. The community, Anniston, Alabama, is about 25,000 in population. The newspaper circulation is about the same. What Ayers has done is create a foundation, and the foundation now helps run the program with the university. So it's not in ownership yet, but that's the direction it's taking. And what it is graduate students who come to work in the newspaper and then go out to serve in other parts of the community. I'm going to raise just some questions and touch on things lightly, and then I'll turn over to Robert to give all the answers. But he might mention, too, the New London Day is an example of a newspaper run by a trust, Christian Science Monitor, you could say a church. public broadcasting. There are many examples of nonprofit models that are funded from citizen contribution, often by government contribution. So there are many forms of nonprofit ownership. I'm only touching on one. But let me mention the challenges that are involved in nonprofit ownership. And the first one is this. You have to give away the organization in order to have it run by the nonprofit if you're an owner. I've been at the Poynter Institute, I think, over 20 years now. And the CEO, the chairman of the board, the person who succeeded Nelson Poynter is Paul Tash. And he and I kid sometime, his predecessor, Andy Barnes, and I kid, that there are many people who contact them as a CEO to ask, how can I create a nonprofit ownership of my news organization? And the first thing they say is, well, you have to give it away. And therefore, they don't hear much from anybody anymore. And you don't hear many people coming back and say, let me follow up on that. Nelson Poynter gave away his paper. He had a wife. He had two children. He gave it away to a school so that it could own his newspaper. And that's a big hindrance. And I, as I've studied this matter, I find that family situation plays a lot in it. Some of the more aggressive models are where there are either small families or there's some sort of breakdown in the family. But you have to give it away. The other thing is, the big thing now is that it is a for-profit that pays for the operation of the nonprofit. The for-profit has to make money. It has to make money. And in the 35 years of operation of the Poynter Institute, I think it's a good example, that did not seem to be a problem. That was not a problem up until more recently. The downturn that affects the industry affects nonprofit-owned news organizations, too. The newspaper is a for-profit. If advertising collapses, it affects the newspaper, too. If its proceeds are down, it affects the dividends we get. And so the news in this situation, nonprofit ownership of a for-profit, the for-profit still has to make money for the operation to go forth as intended. I sometimes see so much of what's changed since Nelson Poynter died. He died in about 1978, and it was interesting how he was ahead of his time, but I wonder if he ever envisioned a time when newspapers weren't making the sort of high double-digit profits that they had been making most of his time and most of the time that the Institute has existed. You've heard of some of the other problems. What are the restrictions in editorial opinion? There's some indications that to create some for-profits, a not-for-profit is restricted in its opinions. We can't, the Poynter Institute can't bring in political candidates, can't take sides in certain disputes. For a news operation to be nonprofit, it would have to observe some of those restrictions or find a way around it, and to me, that's not known now. Can you have a strong news operation that does not express its opinion, that does not take stands on issues? One of the issues is, should the law affecting foundations be changed so the foundations can own newspapers? And there's some possibility there. But also consider, what does foundation ownership mean? First of all, consider the extent of funds required of a foundation to own an active and useful news operation. It's more than just a little bit, and we're seeing now with many startups that a foundation might be able to fund it for a year, a few years, but it takes a lot to really have a solid news operation, and most foundations are not equipped for a sustained effort of funding a news operation. Then as a matter of editorial independence, foundations are often run by people who have strong opinions. Can a news organization be independent in its approach to news with a foundation as owner? Sometimes that might work, but it's not a guarantee. Let me give my conclusions and turn this over to Robert. My conclusions are that there's a lot to be said for nonprofit ownership, but it's not a panacea. It has a lot of problems. I think it's worth exploring much more. It's worth taking a much greater look at what's all involved in nonprofit ownership. How can we make it work? But unfortunately now, I think there's so many people who think that this is the magic bullet. I can tell you it is a wonderful thing. It is not the magic bullet. Some other things that ought to be considered. And this is the big one for me. I think what's really needed is for citizens to be involved much more actively, assertively, than they are now in the future of news. Can nonprofit ownership work? Nonprofit ownership might mean citizens' contributions to some entity. But whether it's that giving there, or whether it's a continued form of citizens' participation through advertising or some other form, I think the real answer at this point is not to turn to nonprofits, to explore that, but to find ways to get the voice of citizens much more actively involved in the future of news. I don't see a lot now that has citizens saying, other than in this meeting, perhaps some of the questions raised, you know, we care about news, we want to have strong news organizations. In part, I don't think news media have directed citizens in how they can help. But I think what we need most of all is a strong voice of citizens. And then the last thing related to that, I think we have to face something that's been raised here before, and that's news media must raise their standards in producing and reporting the news. There's a lot that's happened. Funding has been decreased in many cases. But there's too much trivialization of what's important. There's too much ignoring of communities. And so for all of this to come together, news media have to raise their standards. And let me pause on that and then listen for your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.